We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest today is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 17th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
We are talking today about the Santa Fe Opera production of Cold Mountain, which is a premiere based on the book by Charles Frazier. And this should be a very exciting summer because of Cold Mountain.
Yeah, there's a lot of buzz about this, Marisha. No matter where I've talked in the past year, at the Metropolitan Opera or Los Angeles Opera, wherever it is, coast to coast, people are asking about Cold Mountain because everybody read this book. This book by Charles Frazier was a first book. It won the National Book Award in 1997. It was the top of the New York Times bestseller list for 61 weeks. And it's now in 40 languages. And the person most surprised about this whole event is Charles Frazier himself, who comes from Tennessee in North Carolina. And he said, you know, for 8 years I struggled with this book, never dreaming that, first of all, it would become the success it is, and then it would become a movie, which many people have seen, the Oscar award-winning movie, and now an opera. He loves that transition into opera, and he's been very much part of the process, which is interesting, because that's not always the case, where you have an author of a book who sometimes can be told not to appear on the set because it's been transformed by a screenwriter, and it doesn't always work. In this case, it's incredible the bonding that's gone on between Charles Frazier and the composer Jennifer Higdon and Gene Shear, who is the librettist. It's been wonderful to research this, and for me personally to be able to interact with these people, because again, when I take on a brand new opera, I haven't heard it, I haven't seen it, I know nothing about it. The libretto wasn't ready, I hadn't heard a note of the music, and I have to write about it. So I decided, well, I will send emails to Charles Frazier, Gene Shear, and Jennifer Higdon. Maybe one of them will get back. All three of them, Mary Charlotte, wrote me essays. I mean, it was marvelous. And then we had long conversations, and everything went into the book, which then I sent back to them, and it has their blessing. So if you want some background on the whole piece, it's in Opera Unveiled. But it is a fascinating. The story itself is amazing. I know you're reading it.
Well, this is the thing. I actually didn't read this, but I'm one of the few people on planet Earth, apparently, who didn't read this book when it came out. And so I've been reading it now, and I've also been listening to the audiobook version of it read by Charles Frazier himself, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And then I watched the movie, which I have to say, I mean, it's very hard, and I think a lot of people in film and in literature will tell you this, it's very, very hard to take a first-rate book and make a first-rate movie.
Exactly.
Out of it. And I think they did a superb job, because you have to cut out so much of it. And with each of these media, opera, movie, and book, they do different things. And one of the things that I loved and was so moved by in the book was these incredible descriptions of nature, of people, and of a certain kind of 19th century harshness, which is almost, I mean, it's almost foreign to us, even though we have our own kind of horror and violence today.
But it's palpable in the book.
It's palpable in the book.
Mm. And they seem to have got this across pretty well in the opera score. I think if people want to do a little homework on this, read the book and leave the movie aside, because it's already a branch off the main source, and the main source is the book. And there's a poetry and a musicality about that book that is very special. And he's writing about his own experience. He's actually, Mary Charlotte, writing about his own family. Let me tell you what he said on that topic. Charles Frazier told me William Pinckney Inman, that's the leading character, Inman, was a real person, one of four Inman brothers, one of them my great-great-grandfather, and none of them slave owners, who joined the Confederate Army at the beginning of the Civil War. Now, we assume that everybody was involved with slavery in that war. Not true. This was a family of subsistence farmers. They didn't have any slaves. But but they joined up to protect their homes, as we'll hear in one of the excerpts. He goes on, nearly all I know about his life and death came from my father and from Inman's sketchy war records and a history of his regiment. Inman fought in a number of Civil War battles, including the horrific Battle of the Crater. He was wounded several times and deserted from a hospital in Raleigh, North Carolina, during the final months of the war. He walked home and died in a gunfight with the Home Guard a few miles from Cold Mountain near Waynesville, North Carolina. So that's the sort of the core, the germ of the story for Charles Frazier. In the writing of it, and I think everyone will see this, there are echoes of the Odyssey, of Homer's Odyssey.
I noticed that.
Yeah, it's very clear, and this is fine, because there's a word about this, intertext, where one great work of literature will be echoed in another. This is an Odyssey. Actually, we all live an Odyssey. It's become part of the vocabulary now. We go on a journey. It's an Odyssey. It's adventure.
Yeah, but not every Odyssey is a real Odyssey. I mean, this is a man who is a deserter who's seen, done, and lived absolutely horrific things in the war, has been very, very badly wounded, knows he cannot live through any more fighting, and walks home.
Home, yeah.
And, I mean, whatever Odyssey I or you, well, I don't know about you, but whatever Odysseys I might have lived are nothing compared to.
No. In fact, again, I asked Charles Frazier about this. I said, what is the connection between Cold Mountain and the Odyssey? And he said, from early on in the writing of Cold Mountain, the basic storyline of the Odyssey provided a sort of template. The weary warrior trying to get home, the woman back home dealing with her own great difficulties, the many delays and obstacles, and the continuing necessity to fight even once home is reached. A number of times during his journey, Odysseus stops and prays to the gods, often about his fears and desires. And whenever I became stuck with my writing, I went back to those prayers, searching for inspiration. So I think that's a beautiful way of the author describing, acknowledging what the connection, the relationship is with the Odyssey. And we'll talk about a few of those as we go through the piece. If people are interested, they can go on YouTube to the Guggenheim's Works and Process series, and you can find out, you can go there and hear a wonderful discussion by the author, the composer, and the librettist. And from that event, I have been given permission to play three excerpts from the opera, accompanied by a piano, Lisa Keller, actually, because nobody has heard the full orchestration yet. I mean, everybody knows the story. The next question I'm asked, how is the music? And I haven't heard it, of course.
Well, this is the great thing about premieres is, I mean, you and I are sitting here in the KSFR studio recording these in advance. Nobody's heard it. And I think it's great that you've got any music at all.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. So the first excerpt of Three Little Ones I'm going to play for you here is Inman, who is this man, wounded soldier, who is going to come home. He will be sung in Santa Fe by the absolutely wonderful Nathan Gunn. And there's a nice little story about Nathan Gunn. Apparently, Charles McKay had been contacted by Jennifer Higdon, the composer. It's her first opera. And she said, well, I'm thinking about writing this opera. What do you think? And he said, well, I'll meet you in New York and we'll talk about it. So that was set. And then he went to Chicago to adjudicate the Met auditions. And another panelist was Nathan Gunn. So he's chatting with Nathan, saying, well, I wish you could come back to Santa Fe. We have to find you a role. And in the course of conversation, this Cold Mountain as a possibility came up, and Charles said, you are Inman. So he left that and he went to New York to meet with Jennifer Higdon, and he said to her, you won't believe this, but we have our Inman. And she said, are we doing the opera?
Had she written it yet?
She hadn't yet written. I mean, she'd written much of it. I mean, she had it pretty well fleshed out. But this was how that started. So Nathan Gunn will be singing Inman here, though the voice you will hear in these excerpts, this is another nice little story, is Jarrett Ott. He is a young baritone from the Curtis Institute who sang the role of Inman at these workshop events. The Curtis Institute did two or three events with Jennifer Higdon, with student singers, and now it was done at the Guggenheim, but Nathan Gunn was busy somewhere else on earth singing, so Jarrett Ott sang for him, and we'll sing this excerpt at the Guggenheim. And out of that, Jared Ott, this young singer from the Curtis Institute who's still studying, has been offered a place in the apprentice program here in Santa Fe, and he will understudy the role of Inman, which is a lovely story, I think. So let's hear a little of Inman's aria near the beginning of the opera. He's been asked by a blind man that if he was blind, if he had an option, what in life would he choose never to have seen? So he describes the horrors of the war he's been in. And in this, his aria, he sings, "I dipped a crust of bread in a cup of broth, turned my face to the sun. Suddenly beneath our feet dynamite thundered, arms, fingers, pieces of legs with boots still on them showered the earth. The metal age has come, and the crust of bread was drenched in blood. The metal age has come." So the opera starts out, Cold Mountain, with a pretty graphic, horrendous, frightening scene that I don't think I'm going to tell you about. You have to go and see this. And then it goes to the hospital, which is where the book starts. Inman has been wounded in these terrible battles and is thinking of deserting. He wants to go home. He's in no fit shape to go back and fight a battle which would probably have happened to him. So he steps over the windowsill of his hospital room one night and starts out on his journey, on his odyssey. So most of the journey, this opera is what happens to him as he gets from the hospital in Raleigh back to Cold Mountain in the Smoky Mountains. And that's interspersed brilliantly by scenes of what's going on at Cold Mountain. We meet Ada Monroe, who is the young woman that he has fallen in love with. They hardly know each other, but they had met briefly before he went to the war, and they're attracted. And she is his goal. He wants to go home. He wants to go to Ada. It's his image and dream of her that keeps him going through this terrible journey. She, on the other hand, is struggling on her own. She is a Southern belle. She was reared in painting and piano and poetry and has no idea of how to survive on a farm alone in the course of this war. Her father, who is a minister, has died, and there's one sweet, touching scene with him. She goes to the graveyard to leave flowers by his grave, and he appears before her and reminds her of the young man who was so fascinated by her when they first met. So these scenes are sort of come and go as we go through Inman's journey. It's so beautifully done in the book and brilliantly done in the opera. And then you see in another part of the stage what's happening at Cold Mountain. At Cold Mountain, Ada meets Ruby. Ruby is a girl of the mountains who has heard that Ada is not surviving too well on her own. She barely has food to eat. She's no idea how to plant crops or anything. And Ruby comes along and says, "I'm going to help you." She's a real rough, wonderful character.
And the friendship between those two is really interesting, because one of them is such an urban kind of, as you say,
helpless.
You know, art, poetry, helpless.
Right.
But also smart, empathetic, knowledgeable, and capable.
A survivor.
She really is. She really is. And you think of her as, oh my God, she's going to melt away, but she doesn't. And Ruby is very, very earthy and very, very practical. And they're just great together.
They're great together. It's two brilliant characters. Again, they're taken very directly from the book and put into the opera. So the second section I'd like to play for you here is between Ruby and Ada, sung by Emily Fons and Isabel Leonard. They were both create these roles here in Santa Fe. This is a point at which Ruby is taking Ada in hand. I mean, she's a bit disgusted that this young woman knows nothing about how to do anything that's practical. And she's telling her. And in this little section, Ruby sings, "What do you hear? You say you want to know the running of this land. Listen, listen, Ada. I just hear sound, wind, bird songs, nothing, just sounds. Can't you hear how the world sounds different every day? Ruby says, listen, listen, it's alive. It's growing and dying, and it whispers something new all the time. Ada, the wind and the trees, a dry, brittle rattle. I hear the dry, brittle rattle of dying leaves. That line comes directly from the book. There are many, many lines in this libretto that are come directly from the book. Ada sings, I hear trees. Ruby, trees, trees, just trees. You have a long way to go. Ada, I'm trying.
What do you hear? You say you want to know the running of this land. Listen, listen. Adjust your sounds, wind, bird songs. Nothing, just sounds.
Can't you hear?
Is the duet between Ruby and Ada, and we are going to be introduced to one of the true villains of literature.
Yeah, Teague. The character Teague. Teague apparently was a real character. He was the head of the Home Guard, and these people were notorious for the way they went around the country looking for deserters, and they were cruel, barbaric, evil men. In the very first scene of the opera, he kills an older farmer because he believes he's hiding his son, who is a deserter. So the character of Teague is marvelous. And it will be extraordinary in this production because it's going to be played by J. Hunter Morris. J. Hunter Morris is a Texan who comes complete with the accent, who said in an interview how happy he is to be creating a role in his own language. He says, the biggest expense for me these days for being a singer is having coaches, paying coaches to learn Russian and Czech and French and German. He's an amazing performer. He sang the role of Captain Ahab in Moby Dick. That brought him to fame. He stood in at the last moment for Siegfried in the Metropolitan Opera's Ring Cycle with extraordinary success. So this man is a real character, and he in this cut is actually singing a piece. It's called "Offense Is a Good Thing." This is a song of his. Teague leads into a quartet where each of the characters, Ada, Ruby, and her father Stobrod, whom we haven't met yet, sing and interpret the lines differently. What are the fences that we deal with? And the fences between peacetime and wartime, what is that line? So I'm going to play you a little of that from this wonderful event, Works and Process, held at the Guggenheim Museum in New York in March that you can get on YouTube. Teague sings, a fence is a good thing. You build it right, nothing's ever going to move it or change it. Miss Ada, we're all trying to do in this war is build a fence, keep those people up north from coming down here and telling us how to live our lives. A fence is a good thing, marks what's yours, what's not, even after you're gone. Some borders can't be crossed, some wounds will never heal, some things you can't forget, hearts buried beneath regret. You are who the war reveals. And that line becomes a wonderful line when it's picked up by all the other singers who have different interpretations of what that means.
It's also kind of chilling because at a different point in the book, they keep a woman from moving by sticking her hand in a fence.
Yeah, no, they close a fence over. They torture. These were ruthless people.
Horrible.
And there's that line runs through the whole book. And Teague will personify that in this piece and as sung by this particular performer, J. Hunter Morris. It should be quite something. So let's hear a little of J. Hunter Morris sing A Fence Is a Good Thing from Cold Mountain.
A fence is a good thing. You build it right, nothing's gonna move it or change it.
we're trying to do in this war is build a fence. Keep those people up north from coming down here and telling us how to live our lives. A fence is a good thing. Marks what's yours and what's not, even after you're gone. Some borders can't be crossed. Some wounds will never heal. Some things you can't forget. Who you are, the war reveals. Yes, a fence is a good thing.
And that was the evil villain Teague singing about offense is a good thing. And I have to say, it's so interesting to have both Southern diction and this incredible opera diction happening simultaneously. It's
exactly,
really cool.
Yeah, and it is, of course, in English with Texan Smoky Mountain accent.
Right, right. We're talking about the opera Cold Mountain with Desiree Mays. And it's very interesting to me because, first of all, the language in this book, and part of the reason I wanted to listen to it on audiobook read by the author, who has this absolutely charming accent and is a good reader. Not always do you find that authors are good readers of their own work, but this one really is. It is a very, very musical language that he uses. Incredible language. You just can't even imagine how long he labored over those sentences because they're so beautiful, even as they describe everything from the greatest beauty to the greatest horror. There's also a theme of music in the book. Mm.
Yes, there is. That's, and I first wondered about this when I talked to Jean Scheer. Jean Scheer is a librettist who's done extraordinary work in taking great books and turning them into opera libretti. I mean, he took Herman Melville's Moby Dick and turned that into an opera. I mean, that's extraordinary. He did have a lovely comment about this. He became friends with Charles Frazier, but he said, asked to compare the two, he said, well, one thing about writing Moby Dick was that I didn't have to worry about getting emails from Herman Melville. I think he's had a few from Charles. So, it is a good question. How do you get from a book that's 356 pages down to a libretto that is 82 pages? So that's an interesting topic. But on the topic of music, Scheer said that he talked to Frazier about how this transition happened. He said, in opera, when characters like Ada and Inman sing together, they reveal in music the nature of their relationship. There is a melody in Frazier's sentences that weaves its ways so beautifully throughout the book, giving the story a musical atmosphere. In many ways, the words invite music in. I love that. The words invite music in. That's what appealed to me in transforming the book into an opera. And then within the opera, we meet the character Stobrod, who's a real ne'er-do-well. He's abandoned his daughter, Ruby, to fend for herself since she was very young. He drinks, and he went off to the war, and he too is a deserter. And he shows up, putting Ada and Ruby at risk because Teague is on the lookout for deserters. But he tries to insist with his daughter, Ruby, that he's a changed man and that it was music that has changed him. He says he is always looking for notes that work. You see, a tune that works is like a habit. It gives order to a day's end. In the book, Frazier describes Stobrod's method of composition. He found the pattern he was seeking, and he followed the trail of notes where they led, finding the way of their logic, which was brisk, brittle, effortless as laughing. It's a lovely way of describing it. So then I asked the composer, Jennifer Higdon, what about the musicality of the mountain music, the Appalachian folk music that has to be part of this. And she said that, yes, she had written music in that is reminiscent of that. And it's in the score. I haven't heard this yet. But she said that given the fact that Kevin Burdett, who's a wonderful singer who plays many different character roles, will sing Stobrod in the premiere. It turns out Kevin Burdett, when he started out, was a violist in the early part of his career. He will actually play this fiddle music on stage as Stobrod. And she said then, Jennifer Higdon said, I did honor mountain-style music, those aspects of fiddling that are part of the bluegrass tradition. The use of open strings and a strong emphasis on the offbeat, a mournful sort of sound that I associate with old-time singing or Appalachian folk songs. Some of this I did instinctively, having grown up in East Tennessee around this music, so I'm sure there are things I put into the music that reflect that sound, which I did unconsciously. So with all of that in mind, I thought I could play you two little pieces of music here that are not from the opera, but will give you a sense of where we are with Appalachian music, starting with Straight Appalachian Fiddle Music by Jim Ball, Mountain Man. So now compare that, the real thing, Appalachian fiddle music, with some of Jennifer Higdon's music called the Roarin' Smokies from a concerto of hers, take 6-4-3. Listen for the rhythms.
It's true. Appalachian fiddle music and the music of Jennifer Higdon.
Huh.
Now, tell us more about the composer and how she came to compose the opera Cold Mountain.
Yeah, she's a very well-known American composer who has had extraordinary success as a contemporary classical composer. She's won 4 Grammys for 4 pieces. You can hear her music again on YouTube. Check that out if you'd like to get a sense of what her sound is, since no one's heard the orchestration yet and won't until the premiere. There'll be 5 performances. It starts on August the 1st at the Santa Fe Opera. She's had tremendous success, but this, as I say, is her first opera. And she's been thinking for years of doing this. She's been listening to opera, going to opera, watching how the whole thing is structured and formed, and was wondering what about a topic. She was friends with Jean Shear, the librettist, who called her one day and said, "What do you think about Cold Mountain as a topic for an opera?" And instantly she identified with it. It turns out she had been reared in North Carolina and Charles Frazier in Tennessee, or the other way around. But as the bird flies, they are 60 miles apart, which is amazing.
That is amazing.
Amazing. So she felt totally at home with the subject matter. She met with Charles Frazier. She said that when they did meet, she felt as nervous as a schoolgirl meeting the author of the book she was going to transform form. Yeah. They've had a marvelous interaction. He's taken her and Jean Shear, driven them round the trails of Cold Mountain, so they really get a sense of place. So that's where it started, and then, of course, it went. She was told by everyone, oh, this is opera should premiere at the Santa Fe Opera. We are known for our premieres, and this is an ideal setting with that outdoor sense. You brought up the question of how does one do in an opera transform the extraordinarily beautiful narrative sections of nature, of the land he goes through the night skies in an opera on a stage. Obviously, all that has to be cut. That narrative cannot be in an opera. We have to see it.
Yeah.
And the way it's been done is really rather imaginative, because the story goes from A to B. Odysseus goes from one place to another, right? It's a linear story. How do you do that on a stage where you're limited, you know, limited in sight? So what they've decided with a really brilliant designer, Robert Brill, at first look, this set looks like a welter of dark planks that has a stark beauty of modern sculpture and the randomness of a bunch of pickup sticks tossed onto the floor. But the stage action turns it into a charred plank road or a fallen church. Planks become the hospital bed for Inman when he is wounded. A high-tech motorized assembly of planks with hidden pneumatic and hydraulic parts even becomes a moving boat capable of transporting characters from one place to another across water. They do amazing things with this pile of planks. Extraordinary things can be done, of course, with lighting. There will be some projections. Projections are now becoming a part of opera to give us a sense of where Inman is at different times. There are lovely sections. For instance, at one point, he walks for 28 days in the book, starving and losing hope, just watching the night sky. He's out of food. He's trying to get back to Ada and to Cold Mountain. And the way this is done with the movement of the moon, the complete cycle of the moon in 28 days, with stars that will have Santa Fe's natural stars, stars in the sets, and stars apparently that will fill the house. And on either side of the stage, Inman is singing to Orion, the constellation, at the same time that Ada is singing to the same constellation. So even though they are miles apart, these two rarely come together, actually. They are the flashbacks, they're together and at the end. But at this point, they are joined by their thoughts, by their love. And it's so beautifully done in this theater. This should be quite spectacular.
I guess we should go on with the story. And it's, I guess most people know that it's doesn't end happily, but I don't want to give it away, but we always give it away, so.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we won't give it away. Well, once he leaves the hospital and starts this odyssey, a series of extraordinary episodes happen to him, some that are wonderful, some that are terrible. He is pursued by the home guard who want to kill him. He meets a corrupt clergyman, Vizi, who is about to throw a young girl off a cliff because she has got pregnant by him and he can't deal with the disgrace. So Inman stops his journey and intervenes, and he rescues the girl and castigates Vizi. He goes on later, he meets this same Vizi when he is being pursued by the home guard over Cape Fear River, and he's in a boat. The two men are in this boat that's done with the hydraulic thing with the planks. It's incredible. And the home guard are firing at them. The boat tips over, and they are rescued by Lila and her sisters, who are definitely the sirens from the Odyssey.
Yeah.
These are rough, evil women who do not want these two men to escape. The husband of one, Junior, drugs their drinks, and while the two women are assaulting, literally, and seducing Inman, the husband goes off and brings the home guard, and they are captured. He does it for the ransom money. Inman is attached to a chain gang and force marched back towards the east, but there is a fight. The men on the chain gang all end up dead in a pile of bodies, with Inman at the in this pile, which again has an echo of the Odyssey, where Odysseus goes into Hades, into hell, and suffers the pains, the terrors, the fears of hell, as does Inman at this point. But he's rescued by a black slave woman, Lucinda, who has escaped and is heading north. She finds him alive in this pile that she's pillaging. She's looking for money for food, for anything. And she is the one who gives him the keys to the chains that releases him. So there are all these incredible little episodes. At one point, he hears a woman trying to soothe a crying baby, and he goes to the house. It's a young woman. She's lost her husband. He's died at the war. The infant won't stop crying. So Inman takes the child in his arms and calms the child, and she's grateful. She gives him food, invites him in. And that night, Sarah, her name is, she asks Inman if he would just lie with her. Not that anything else should happen, but she needs the comfort. She's desperate. So he does. But the following morning, when she would like him to stay, he has to continue. So this goes on and on. On his side, on the other side, then we meet Ada and Ruby, and Ruby's incredible father, Stobrod, who finally is chased up the mountains and discovered by Teague, who shoots him and his friend Pango. The two women decide in the winter snow they have to go and bury the men. So Ruby and Ada, who is now not dressed in a pretty Southern Belle dress, but in breeches with a shotgun, head up the mountain. They find that the friend, Pangol, is dead, but Stobrod is just about living. So they decide they'd take him to a little cabin until he's well enough and then head back to the farm. At that point, Ada goes off with the shotgun to shoot some wild turkeys for food, and as she does so, she sees just the shape of a figure in the snowy road in front of her, and she doesn't know who it is, so she aims her shotgun and would fire, and the man says to her, "Don't shoot, we don't even know each other yet." You know, something along those lines. They don't recognize each other.
Right.
And this, of course, happened in the Odyssey when Odysseus returned after all those years of traveling Penelope, and he did not recognize each other.
Only the dog recognized Odysseus.
Oh, that's right,
a
only
good,
the dog.
Good dog.
Yeah, exactly. So, but he said, he turns to leave and says something to her, and she recognizes his voice. And finally, at the end of this opera, these two are reunited, and they spend some days together in this snowy cabin as the two men are recovering, and then it's time to go back to Cold Mountain to the farm. The women leave first with Stobrod, who has to be carried, and Inman says he will follow them up. And as he brings up the rear, he's surrounded by Teague and the men, and there's a shootout. And Inman shoots all of the home guard. He kills Teague. The men fall, and he's about to leave when he realizes there's a young boy who'd been with this group who is hiding in the bushes. And he says to the boy, "I don't want to shoot you. Throw your guns out. Come out. I'll let you escape. I don't want to kill you." And the boy throws out a gun, and then he comes out from behind the bush, raises a gun, and fires at Inman, who falls. Ada hears the gunshot, and she comes rushing back, and she holds the dying Inman in her arms. And he does die at the end of the story. But there is a little epilogue that I don't think I'll give away that brings this story of what then is tragedy back to somewhere of hope, of faith, and love, that his journey was not wasted, that this man, who was the anti-hero in many, many people's minds, he was a deserter, had gone through so much and had shown such compassion and understanding for the people he met on the way, his love for Ada, and what happens in that little epilogue at the end reinstates our faith, perhaps, in the tragedy that has just occurred, and this whole statement about war and the horror that happens and how they had survived it.
So that's the end of the story,
mm-hmm.
But we've got another piece of music.
We do. There's a lovely piece of music that will give you a sense of Jennifer Higdon's lovely elegiac style. This is a piece called Blue Cathedral that she actually wrote shortly after her brother had died. They were both musicians, and they were very close, and he died young. And she wrote this very beautiful piece of music for him called Blue Cathedral. It's a short piece, but I'm only going to play a brief section of it.
Thank you.
there we have it, ladies and gentlemen, Cold Mountain premiering this summer at the Santa Fe Opera. Mm-hmm.
There'll be five performances, and it's selling out rapidly.
So
the first few, I think, are sold out, but call sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
And don't miss this. This is going to be, this could be the great American opera, actually. The subject matter is important. It's an American story, an American artist with American artists all around in the production team, the creative team. So it's something I think that holds great promise, and I can't wait to hear it.
We want to talk about a few other things, as we always do, relating to the Santa Fe Opera, and one of them is that there is an excellent apprentice program, and a lot of the people who are opera apprentices here at the Santa Fe Opera go on to sing major roles, sometimes here and often in other opera companies, and so you can actually go, there's an event, there are events where apprentices are singing scenes from various operas on August 16th and August 23rd, and you can kind of, like, I've been to those once or twice, and you look at them and you say, wow, one of these days, you know, 5-10 years from now, I'm going to see this person in the Metropolitan Opera,
yes.
Right.
Yes, it happens. For instance, Ruby, who is Emily Fons, was an apprentice singer when she first came here, and she has done very well. Many of our singers are invited back. They come as apprentices, and years later they make their names and they come back and sing for us. So those apprentice programs are great fun to see. They're very inexpensive. Call the box office for tickets. They are produced by the main stage directors, and they have music, they have coaching, they have everything as if it's the real thing. And they are full scenes from operas with these apprentices. Thousands of people, Mary Charlotte, apply for these few slots of 40 each year. They're whittled down. They are not novices who are beginning a career. They are well into their training. Many of them have sung leading roles. So they come to learn. If they have been apprentices at the Santa Fe Opera, it opens all sorts of doors for them.
And they also are understudies for major roles. So
that's
occasionally,
right.
if a singer gets injured or has a voice problem or whatever, the understudy steps in. And I've heard stories about how a singer was actually injured on stage, walks off as best they can, the understudy walks
back on,
and some people didn't even know.
Well, I don't know about that, but heard that story. Yeah, but that's what they're supposed to do. They are, when they are contracted to be apprentices, they're assigned 1, 2, 3 operas. That gets tricky because they also are the chorus, and if they're doubling in 2 or 3 different operas, the rehearsal schedule is so tight when we're trying to put on one opera a week. That's the way it works. At the beginning, we bring up 2. There are 2 for opening weekend and then a different opera in following weeks. So it's a tight schedule for them, and they have to be alert and aware. And they are wonderful. They are the singers of the future, many of them. And I would encourage people to go to the apprentice scenes, call the box office for tickets. Another example, of course, is the singer who's understudying Inman, Jared Ott, this young singer from the Curtis Institute. He's not finished. He sang in the workshop performances Nathan Gunn wasn't available, and now he's in the apprentice program, and he's here to understudy Nathan Gunn should anything happen. God forbid. We have two Inmans then if we need. So that's been a big success, and the company is known for this. We also have a sort of a apprentice program, if you like, with stage crew and stage craft that all sorts of people learn different aspects of opera here. They are also auditioned, and they come here. They work with the scenery, props, many different roles, which is great for their careers. No better place to learn than at the Santa Fe Opera, especially now with the renovation, because now all those spaces that were so cramped and tight and nearly impossible to work in before have been expanded and opened up. So it's now the real thing.
And as we talked about earlier in another program recently, the opera shop has been beautifully expanded and renovated, and every year there's an opera poster by an artist, a New Mexico artist.
Right. Dan Naminga, who is a famous artist now, he has done our poster for a number of years. This year it's a very beautiful one. It's a snow-infused trees, which is very appropriate. The opera shop is open during the season from 10 to 4:30, and then it opens before the performance. performance in the intermission, and you can go there afterwards as well. So they stock all sorts of wonderful gift things, a lot of things for the operas. They have a number of CDs. They will have Craig Smith's book about John Crosby, A Vision of Voices, of course. That will be there as well. So lots of things to browse in the shop, and it's great that we have that shop there.
Desiree Mays, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we want to talk about a couple more things before we go. Charles Frazier himself, and this is huge, is going to be in Santa Fe. The man who wrote the actual book, Cold Mountain, is going to be in Santa Fe on Wednesday, the 29th of July at Collected Works Bookstore.
Yes, you better get there early. It's 6 o'clock if you want to get into that. I think we should have had the Lensic for that, quite honestly. But it's great that Dorothy Massey at Collected Works is so supportive of the opera and so many, many writers that she will be hosting Charles Frazier to talk about Cold Mountain on July 29th at Collected Works at 6 p.m. I will be doing another overview talk on the operas in Albuquerque at Bookworks on July the 12th at 3 in the afternoon. That's a Sunday. So if you didn't get all of these shows and you missed the podcasts, which Mary Charlotte puts up after the shows, it'll be lovely to meet you and to talk to you and to tell you about the five operas of the season at Bookworks on July 12th at 3 o'clock.
We want to mention one more event, and I think we've already talked about it, but let's just mention it briefly. There is a 3-day symposium put on by the opera from starting on July 31st, and that is open to the public, and Cold Mountain is definitely going to be a theme.
Yes, absolutely. It's at the New Mexico History Museum. It's focused on Cold Mountain, and you can call the box office or go to santafeopera.org or ask for Andrea Waters, and you'll get all of the details and sign up. Sign up early for that. It's always fascinating. It's another way of coming to a topic that's dealt with in an opera, whether it's about the Civil War situation, relating it to today's experience. I mean, what happens in this opera is happening as we speak, the horror of soldiers who are being mortally wounded in these terrible battles and how they deal with it. That's very contemporary. And as I say, on Saturday morning, there will be a presentation of the creative team to talk about the whole production that will premiere that night. So call the opera company, santafeopera.org, to sign up for that.
Desiree Mays, once again, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's been fun as always.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet of the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number here in New Mexico is 505-986-5900.